Okay, well, good morning, everyone. For those of you who have come from the Soil Awards breakfast and listened to Kate Scow talk, you'll see a lot of elements of that talk here, with the exception of the rap song at the end, okay? I didn't have time to develop one after that ended and before this started, but very creative talk. So I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors here. All of us are involved in the USAID Feed the Future Sustainable Intensification Innovation Lab at Kansas State. So a lot of this talk will be talking reference to smallholder farmers around the world. Not all of it, but there will be a heavy emphasis in that direction. So I want to talk just a little bit about soil ecosystem services. We're talking about human nutrition here and relating that to soil chemical processes, and talk about food and soil security, a little background on human nutrition to keep ourselves focused, then get into the soil chemistry part of it, what are the critical soil reactions and processes related to food security, apply some of those concepts, and then look to the future and do a little bit of visioning before wrapping this up. So you're probably all familiar with the concept of ecosystem services, regulating, cultural, supporting, and this talk is going to focus on the provisioning aspects, that is the capability of the soil to provide for us. And the main point that I want to make here is that it is related to not only the quantity of food, but the quality. So it's calories as well as the nutritional components. And both are very, very important as we discuss food security. And the other point that I'll make throughout the presentation is I'm taking a very broad view of this, and that is our goal is to improve human nutrition. And soils play a very important part of that. I hope you'll get at least that out of it. But then also, as soil scientists, we need to keep from having tunnel vision and look at all the opportunities to improve human nutrition, as well as what the barriers are to implementing those opportunities as we go about our work. So I kind of like to turn this around, as Alex McBratney has done, and talk about soil security. Okay, what does it mean when we have soil security? We protect that soil resource and all that it stands for, and food security and some other securities come right along with that. So we're going to talk both about soil security as well as food security. So in the global sense, if you want to talk about the relationship between the soil resource and the livelihood, the goodness of the population, I consider these must-reads, if you haven't read them already, all about how soils can lead to the rise and fall of civilizations. Daniel Hillel, of course, is a well-known figure in the soil science community. He wrote a book almost over 20 years ago, Out of the Earth, that goes through a lot of that history. Jared Diamond, a little bit more famous person, and Collapse, and he talks about several scenarios. And then David Montgomery, more recently, with Dirt and the Erosion of Civilization. So David is not a soil scientist, so he can say dirt instead of soil. But if you haven't read these, I strongly encourage you to do so. More recently, the Intergovernmental Technical Panel on Soils released the status of the world soil resources. This came out in World Soil Day in 2015, so not quite 2 years ago. Identified three major threats to the soil resource: soil erosion, soil carbon change, and nutrient imbalance. And the imbalance is both in the positive and the negative side. So you're beginning to see a little bit of the soil chemistry come into the scene here. And then additional threats, and you're all very familiar with us, salinity, sodium. Sealing is really refers to paving things over. It's not the formation of a crust, but loss of land to urbanization and other things. Loss of biodiversity, as we just heard about with Kate Scow's talk. Acidification, contamination, compaction, and water logging as a significant threat. So again, the soil chemistry is beginning to come in here, and then we'll try and relate that to food security. So I like to look at maps to sort of draw some general relationships. This is economic status of various countries. The darker the color, the poorer the country. So you have basically four different categories: highly developed, well-off countries as measured by GDP or GDP per capita. And then what you see, of course, is kind of a swath here from South America across Africa into South Asia with lesser developed economies, so more poverty and possibly more hunger. If you look at that from a soil resource standpoint, it's no coincidence that across this same band you have what I consider to be some of the soil orders that have the greatest challenges for food production. So your oxisols, your ultisols, a little bit of verdisols, and then some of the erythrosols, which of course are limited by water availability. But some of the more challenging soils to deal with. Not impossible, but requiring perhaps more management, more input to be productive for a country to be food secure. And then if you further overlay that with a hunger index or some indication of the degree of the population that's hungry, and again, it follows that same pattern with some of the worst countries, of course, being in Africa. A lot of gains have been made in South America and in parts of Asia, but still, as we often hear, a significant amount of the world's population goes to bed hungry every night. Now, correlation is not causation, so we can't equivocally say that, or unequivocally say that soil has produced, the lack of soil resources has produced that hunger. I think that's true, but all we really have to do is to say, well, from today, if we want to improve things, what do we have to work with? And those soil relationships are clearly there. They're the most challenging soils that we have to work with, and we'll get into some of that as we go along. More recently, the Sustainable Intensification Lab has done some work assessing soil fertility status and the barriers to improving soil fertility status in sub-Saharan Africa. We're just tabulating these results now, but I can share a little bit of it with you. We divided sub-Saharan Africa into four different areas where we surveyed, and we also had a summit on this back in August. East and West Africa, the Great Lakes region, Ethiopia as an individual country because of the complexity of the landscape there. But you can clearly see nitrogen deficiency is usually ranked the number one limiting factor in terms of what would it take to increase soil fertility, low soil organic carbon content, P deficiency, acidity, low available water holding capacity, and micronutrient deficiency across those four regions were all the factors that were in the top five. And we had a really good sample on this. We had nearly 500 people that responded to the survey who had expertise in sub-Saharan Africa. Many of them were in Africa. Some of them were at universities here in the U.S. and other places that work in that region. So it gives you a pretty good idea of, you know, what some of the limiting factors are, not only from the soil standpoint, but from the input standpoint. So I like to look at the flow of nutrients from the soil with this diagram. And of course, you know, we're all interested in here, and the nutrients here, of course, go into plants, and then from plants they can perhaps be consumed directly by animals or processed into some feed that goes into the animals. And of course, we eat the animals or the animal products. And sometimes we process the plants into some sort of a processed food type thing. It could be as simple as grinding something into flour and baking it, or it could be much more complicated to that. And of course, we consume the plants directly, so lots of ways for these nutrients to get into the humans. And every place where I have an asterisk there, which is all of those steps, is an opportunity for nutrient input. Okay, so it's not all about what do we have here and how do we end up here. It's all of the what I call entry points for nutrients, and how can we work with those to improve human nutrition. And if you're interested in things like bioavailability, it really spans all of these areas. I'll get into that in a little more detail. Everything from, you know, what's the bioavailability of iron in the soil and why is that so challenging from an iron nutrition standpoint, to what's the bioavailability of iron in spinach versus iron in red meat in a human diet. And they're substantially different. I don't have time to go into all of those factors, but it is an important consideration. And then if we look at each of these individually, to look at the soil, of course, the total quantity of nutrients. We'll get into the concept of peak soil, the bioavailability, what are the soil nutrient cycles, and how can we capitalize on that to enhance bioavailability, to provide adequate nutrition. And of course, we have an opportunity to input nutrients here through fertilization. And in fertilization, I'm speaking broadly, any source of plant nutrients, not just inorganic fertilizer. You look at the plant, of course, the nutrients supplied by the soil for the most part, a lot of rhizosphere and microbiome effects that we need to be concerned about. Sometimes the plants can modify their own environment to enhance nutrient availability. And then, going back to Kate Scow's talk, you know, maybe we can understand this microbiome effect a little bit and manage it, if you will, to improve plant nutrition. And we have another opportunity for nutrient input through foliar feeding of crops, and I'll show you a little bit on that later on. We go down to the animals. Of course, they're getting forages and feed, microbiome effects here as well in the digestive system of the animals and other things. Bioavailability is still here. We have the opportunity to supplement the animals, which then influences the quantity, the quantity as well as the quality of the meat and the animal products. And we have opportunity to fortify foodstuffs here. So vitamin D in milk is a good example that we're fortifying that before it goes for human consumption. Processed food, a lot of issues related to loss of nutritional value and how we process, just simply taking the bran off of grains reduces the nutrient value. We also have opportunities for fortification here, so adding iron to flour, iodine to salt, and other things that enhances human nutrition. And then, of course, humans, we have the bioavailability issue. I already talked about that. Microbiome effects in our own digestive system, we're just beginning to understand. And opportunities to supplement. I mean, it seems fairly trivial that why don't we all just take a multivitamin every day? That would solve a lot of problems, especially in developing countries, but you'd be surprised at how difficult that is to implement. But as soil scientists, we need to keep all of this in mind as we move to go from here to actually improving human nutrition. So a little bit on nutrition, human nutrition, and I divide this into developing versus developed countries. And again, it's about energy and nutrition. It's not just calories. It's the quality of those calories and whether we're meeting the nutritional needs. We talk about food security and therefore insecurity, and it comes in a lot of different flavors, acute versus chronic, seasonal versus occasional. There may be nutrient deficiencies as well as caloric deficiencies. It's not a simple thing of simply being hungry. And the primary symptoms that we're looking for in a population of developing countries are dangerously thin for one's height, clinical deficiencies in vitamins and zinc, iron, iodine, and vitamin A worldwide are the four that have the greatest impact. Underweight for age and stunting. If you look at some of the numbers, it's really quite shocking if you think of just take stunting and here some of these countries in Africa and in Asia, you know, up to 44% of the children are stunted because of poor nutrition. You think about walking through an elementary school in the United States, if we saw that, we would certainly do something about it. They're trying to do that in these countries as well, but it's a difficult problem. And one of the problems is that as a child develops, you know, they're in very critical growth stages for many, many years, and nutrient deficiency for a short time can have lifelong impact. For developed countries, the symptoms of malnutrition are, as I say, more subtle or delayed. It might be a question of excess calories, which also can impact developing countries, or cancer or anemia, things that are not as obvious, osteoporosis. We do talk about vitamin supplementation, and you look at the ads that we're all deficient in something, and I don't think we're necessarily deficient in a whole lot, but sometimes we get a positive response, and there might be something to that. And then some of these other considerations, in a way, I think of these almost as luxury. You know, if you want to be on the paleo diet, for example, well, calcium, you might be a little deficient there, or vitamin D. If you're vegan, maybe iron or vitamin B12. And then a lot of interest in other conditions like celiac that affect our ability to absorb nutrients can have an impact. This idea of peak soil comes up for both developing and developed countries, and I define it as limitations in provisioning both the quantity and the nutrient density of food due to the depletion of plant or human essential elements from soils. And you think about this, I mean, simple mass balance says that we clearly are depleting our soils in some areas. I mean, we're removing more than we're putting into the system, and there's only so much in the soil. And this is clearly an issue in many developing countries. And if you look at some of the estimates of the impact of that in terms of our ability to produce just the quantity of food, there's some folks who have done this, and here they've taken N, P, and K and looked at developing and least developed countries and what they think the nitrogen deficiency is costing us, all addressed or corrected, I should say, to equivalent rice yield. And you look at this number, the average across all nutrients in all countries, it's a substantial amount of rice production. So 433, that's teragrams per year. So that's 433 million metric tons of rice that we're missing out on because of inadequate nutrients in our production systems. And then in the developed worlds, we see this in different ways. You know, peak soil, why is nutrition disappearing from our food? And of course, this is usually pushing something. They want to perhaps sell you a vitamin or something. Seven hidden causes of fatigue, lost nutrients, peak soil, why are we taking, or are we taking more than the earth can give? I could give a whole talk on this subject alone. There's evidence to suggest some of this is true and evidence that it's not so much true. But I like the FAO's take on this. You know, soil is where the food begins, and I think that's a good way to move forward. Now, going back to the soils, and I mentioned, mentioned Kate Scow's talk, and she talked about CLORP, the soil-forming factor, so that's where this is going to come from. And here's the inset of the soil, the world soil map that had the soil orders. We were talking about ultisols and vertisols, etc. Well, on the left here, the entisols, in a way, are time zero in soil formation. All right, it's not quite as simple as that. Sometimes it is. Those weather into lightly weathered or lightly developed soils, in septisols and andisols. And then what I've taken over here are the six soil orders that really represent the bulk of the agricultural production around the world. So everything from the erythrosols at the top, myelosols, vertisols, alphasols, ultisols, and oxisols. At the top and at the bottom, you have very low soil organic carbon content for a variety of reasons. And then also, as you move down, generally, what's happening through the soil formation process is that we're decreasing CEC, so we're losing our 2-to-1 minerals, we're losing our base cations, we're gaining 1-to-1 minerals, or hydrous oxides, which are strong sinks for things like phosphorus. We're losing organic matter, and we tend to become more acidic. So if you look then again at the region of the globe that I pointed out, South America, across Africa, into Asia, you know, we're mostly dealing down in this range. So inherently, soils that are inherently low in native fertility. Okay, so that through the soil forming process, you know, it all makes sense. You look at the minerals that are present and extrapolate that to things like cation exchange capacity. It all makes sense. So these are what I consider to be the critical soil reactions or characteristics or properties for food security. So bioavailability, soil reaction or acidity or basicity, both low and high soil pH, phosphorus fixation, low organic carbon content, low cation exchange capacity, salinity and sodicity. Don't have time to go through all of these, but we'll go into a little bit of the chemistry of a few of these. So I like to illustrate the concept of bioavailability with this diagram. And it's a bit complicated, but it covers everything from nutrients, which we're going to talk about, to contaminants and inhalation of dust or exposure on your skin, the whole nine yards. From a nutrient standpoint, really what we're interested in is mostly what's going on here in the soil solution, because this is where the plants, of course, obtain their nutrients from. So this is an obvious critical interaction here, which I've just generalized into sorption and desorption. Lots of processes involved. There are lots of interesting chemistry, but generally the nutrients that are in these forms are not available for plant uptake, whereas they are here. Organic forms can be very, very critical in soils that don't have a lot of native soil fertility, because a lot of that available nutrient pool is going back and forth between these or into the animal or the organism. So here our organism, of course, is a plant root. There's a little bit of transport. We can move nutrients toward the root, or we can move the root towards the plant nutrients. And then once we get it to the root, we're not quite there yet. We still have to get it into the plant. It has to cross some sort of a biological membrane to be absorbed and then to have the response that we want. So the response in our case is the nutritional quality of whatever part of the plant that we're eating. So you talk about biofortification, agronomic biofortification. You know, we have to get it all the way out here to be deposited into the grain or the leaf or something that we're consuming in order to have the impact that we want, which is to help human nutrition. So a lot of interesting things to talk about there. We don't have a lot of time. Look at soil reaction, again, low and high soil pH. So low soil pH, really, mostly we're talking about aluminum toxicity. It can also be manganese and some other things there. Plays a big role in phosphorus fixation, which I'll talk about in a moment. This little inset here shows exchangeable aluminum as a function of pH. These were a bunch of soils that came into our soil testing lab, and yes, in the U.S. we do have extreme acidity in some places. And what you notice is that there's a break point here, 5 to 5.5. Your exchangeable aluminum goes to 0, okay, which is good. So it's no longer a limiting factor. And the reason that I have management here is because we know how to solve soil acidity problems, but implementing that is very challenging in some environments, even in the U.S. If you're 100 miles from the nearest lime source, you can hardly afford to apply lime. On the high pH side, this will enhance micronutrient deficiencies, so a lot of our aridosols have higher pHs. So things like iron and zinc and some of the critical elements will be very low bioavailability, may indicate salinity or sodicity issues, and may indicate the presence of free carbonates. A lot of maps of soil pH across the globe. I just grabbed this one as based on the balance between ET and precipitation, but it clearly shows, again, across that band, a lot of extreme acidity in some of these areas where it's difficult to manage these. You see the same thing in the U.S., but again, we have the resources and the way to deal with these, although, again, it is an issue in some places. So fixation of phosphorus, basically adding phosphorus, and you're not getting any benefit from it. And there are soils in extreme cases where you can add a whole lot of phosphorus and still have P-deficient plants. So it's a variety of things that are going on there. Precipitation of insoluble solid phases, usually combined with cations, aluminum, iron, perhaps manganese, sometimes calcium in high pH or precarbonate soil, or adsorption to metal oxides. So think about the pH-dependent charge at very acidic conditions. You not only can precipitate things, but you can also have very strong adsorption because the adsorption conditions are highly favorable at acidic pH to adsorb an anion. And then soils with high fixing capacity require special management. You can't just broadcast apply phosphorus and expect to get a benefit from that. If you're a smallholder farmer and you have very limited resources, that would not be a very wise thing to do. On the positive side, if you look at places like South America, Brazil, and Argentina in particular, they have a lot of these soils. They've learned to manage them, but it is a very resource-intensive process. The distribution of these soils, again, follows that pattern very much along with acidity as well as the degree of soil weathering. So fairly significant on a global scale. Even in the U.S., in the southeastern part, we have some issues with this. Low soil organic carbon content, and as I said earlier, sometimes organic carbon may represent the majority of plant available nutrients in a soil system, so we need to be concerned about that. A lot of interest in carbon sequestration, and it's not my area of research, but I've been watching this quite a bit. It seems there's a lot of emphasis on, you know, we need to increase the soil carbon stock, which is good. If we can do it, let's do it. But in tropical environments in particular, it's very difficult to do. I think we need to worry less about that and just look at the benefit of carbon additions almost on an annual basis without necessarily the goal of increasing soil carbon stocks, because it will have a beneficial effect in terms of integrated soil fertility management. A lot of microbiome effects here. Go back to Kate's talk again. She touched on some of these. And really, one of the biggest issues has not much to do with soil science other than the fact we're missing out on carbon is the competing uses for the carbon in many countries as a fuel, fodder, or building materials. Here's an inset from a small dairy farm in India where they're taking the manure and they're making these nice little sort of, I don't know, they're sort of briquettes kind of thing, and they sell them for fuel. The people burn them and cook with that heat. As a soil scientist, of course, we're sitting there thinking, well, gosh, put that back on the soil would have a lot of benefit. Well, that's going to affect their bottom line. You look at Africa and some of the grazing laws that they have, where once a crop is harvested, anybody can freely graze. That crop residue is gone. Between that and the termites and other things, it's really hard to get carbon back into the soil. So, and that's a huge issue related to policy and all sorts of things. We need to be aware of that because we simply can't suggest put more carbon in the soil because it probably won't happen. Look at low cation exchange capacity. It's the predominance of 1-to-1 clays and hydrous metal oxides as opposed to 2-to-1 clays. Or coarse texture and or coarse texture with a high leaching potential and or low soil organic carbon content. All of that reflects low native soil fertility, which reduces the capacity of the soil to retain added plant nutrients. And that raises a lot of issues about soil testing that I'll expand on a little bit here. And I'm going to do that with a couple of example soils from Cambodia. And these are described in this book here, the soils used for rice production in Cambodia. So Cambodia has quite a bit of rice production. This topsoil, it represents about 25% of the rice production areas in Cambodia. So the main things are the acidity here. Look at the aluminum saturation, quite high. Look at the CECs, quite low. These soils have more of a basalt influence in their formation. And you see the higher pHs, you see the higher CECs. So think for a minute how you would manage that soil from a fertility standpoint. Again, wanting to affect human nutrition. So we tend to think of soil testing as, you know, where are we on this continuum, particularly for phosphorus and potassium, you know, anywhere from very low to very high, and then how does that relate to the probability of a response to added nutrients? Well, in Cambodia, you know, you just assume you're over here. You're never going to get over here for a lot of reasons, okay? So really the focus needs to be on what is this response curve? Do we have factors that make us unresponsive? High aluminum saturation, acidity, those sorts of things. How do we get into a situation where we are responsive if we're not? And then what's that response curve look like? Forget anything about build and maintain soil test phosphorus levels or potassium levels. Again, it's not going to happen. So ensure the soil is responsive, and then building soil fertility may not be feasible. So you're almost managing on an annual event. All right, and to bring us back again to ground us a little bit, as part of the survey that I mentioned earlier, we looked at socioeconomic factors that were limits to increasing soil fertility. Access to financial resources. You know, we can prescribe all that we want, but if there's no money to do it, it's not going to happen. So, and this takes many flavors. So you have to get into things like, how do you make fertilizer more available? Are there subsidy programs, other things that can encourage farmers to use it? Because we already know that it works, all right? That's nothing new. It's how do we make it happen? Then you look at some of these other things. It's about knowledge, capacity of the public sector extension programs. You know, so there's a lot of things that you have to fill in to get those recommendations implemented. So real quickly, let's look forward. Future directions, I think it's clear we must replace nutrients removed from the soil system, however we can do that. Integrated soil fertility management has a lot of promise and will progress, and the emphasis is on more locally available nutrient sources of all types, okay? Poor quality phosphate rock to manures to crop residues. I think fertilizer technology will continue to develop, and we'll begin to understand more about the microbiome and how that affects the nutrient status of plants as well as humans, and hopefully be able to capitalize on that. Now, if you really want to look far out there, this is my dreamer slide, okay? You know, what should our long-term goals be? Well, we've been talking about biological end fixation by and for more crop species. And as I understand the genetic side of things and some of the microbiome issues, you know, maybe that's not so far out there anymore. But certainly if we could get maize or rice to fix some of its own nitrogen, or the organisms in the soil to do that, we have great gains. And I often ask students, you know, if you were to create a perfect fertilizer, what would it look like? So I've just thrown out a few ideas here. Probably a solid material, a little easier to work with. And it would release the nutrients when asked to, either by the plant or by us. You know, so maybe that plant would exude something when it needed nitrogen or phosphorus. And you think about genetics and inserting traits, maybe we could work on. There would be no losses due to volatilization, fixation by soil or leaching. And if you really did it right, those nutrients would not be accessible to the weeds, right? You wouldn't allow them to have any of it. All nutrients provided in one material. The ratios of nutrients would match to crop needs, which is another significant problem. And perhaps a single application would last for years. You go out, put it on once, and maybe 5 years later have to do it again. And that would be really cool. Again, dreaming about things. So all stuff for the early career folks to be thinking about. Summary and conclusions, soil properties linked to provisioning as an ecosystem services. These are the critical reactions and processes. The management practices are known in many cases, but not always possible to implement. Again, as soil scientists, we need to think beyond our discipline as to how to make some of these things happen. And I do think research opportunities are plentiful and will continue to be so. So thank you.